listening to those four exquisite singers do that just astrally beautiful song, it's like it's so beautiful you sort of don't know what to do with yourself, is the only way I can think to say it. On Friday night when we were rehearsing for the concert, which is going to be performed after service today, which I hope many of you will come to, Dambara was singing a song that he'll sing for you this afternoon. And it was the same experience, you know, God has given him and many of our singers a great gift in being able to sing, and they've used that gift in divine service, and therefore it's become even more deeply spiritualized. And Swami Kriyananda's music, as he himself says, it's not his music, it's music that he heard and wrote down. Once an interviewer was asking him for a magazine or some interview or something like that, what's your favorite music? And he said, mine, like that. And then he sort of heard how that might sound to an outsider. And he stopped. He said, oh, but you have to realize I to call it mine is really wrong. He said, it's the music that I heard and I wrote down. He said, but it vibrates perfectly with my soul. And therefore, to me, it's the most... He said, if you asked me what the best music was, I wouldn't necessarily give you the same answer. But the question, what's my favorite? Because its vibrations are the closest to his own emanation. That's why he could hear it. Listening to the singing today, and then interestingly, Steve chose to recite the Whispers that talks about going beyond all speech into silence, that I used to pray and now I don't even pray. Now our communication is totally without words. I was realizing that there's no place to go from the beauty of that music except beyond all human-inspired sound altogether, and you have to go into the Om vibration. Last night, we were gathered at Chela Bhavan, where we live, for a little Christmas party, and Patrick's daughter, Leah, is visiting here, and she's also been gifted with a singing voice. When she was born, and Patrick would carry her around to all the choir rehearsals, we all thought, boy, if this girl doesn't sing, this is really a waste of an incarnation. Well, it wasn't wasted. And she's been learning parts of the Messiah and Handel's Messiah. And so Karen got the songbook, and it was just the typical family, wonderful family party. And so Leah, I don't mean to embarrass her, but you know, she's standing up there. She's almost 18 years old. And I was vividly remembering, because I had the privilege of being present literally when she was born. I was in the hospital there, and she didn't breathe completely correctly in her first few seconds, so they whisked her off to wherever those places are where they put the little small babies. It was interesting. This is, I'm going to digress for a minute. A man in that same neonatal ICU had just had quintuplets. And so there were five little babies in these little incubators. There was a little bit of chaos, so we were just walking places we shouldn't have been. And I was sort of looking around, and there's this man, and he's standing against the wall like this. I said to the nurse, the father, they said, yes, like that. <You know. laughs> But in that same time, little Leah, who's, you know, this big, like, less than a half hour old, 10 minutes old, and Patrick is leaning over, and she has her little tiny fingers gripping his little hands like that, and they're looking at each other. You know, it's almost unbearably sweet. It was almost unbearably sweet at the moment, and then seeing the grown woman singing with her father, and, you know, everyone together like that. They're just parts of life that you just don't know what to do with yourself. You don't know whether to weep or to laugh. And then at the same time, similar things happen that of equal intensity that are so tragic. You know, people you love die. People commit suicide. People's dreams get destroyed. You don't know what to do with yourself. But the fact of the matter is, God tells us what to do with ourselves. And he plants his hints or his blatant messages really everywhere. And in this beautiful scripture commentary, I was hungry, I was imprisoned, I was sick, and God says, you took care of me. And the devotee says, oh, wow, that's great. When did I do that, Lord? I was just living my life. I didn't realize I was living it with you. And of course, if we don't realize we're living it with God, then we miss that open doorway that is the real answer to all this endless bliss balanced by this endless suffering. It's a friend of mine was just speaking just 2 days ago, and somebody very, very dear to him had died, and he wasn't aware that her death was imminent, and he was so upset because he had not had a chance to say goodbye, and he had to go to another city for her funeral, and he was very distressed about it. Then he comes back and talks to us and says, because this woman had been such an important figure in his childhood, he reunited with some of his dearest friends from his earlier life, whom he hadn't seen in years. And so he was explaining to us about the unity of that friendship, just coming back together. And I commented to him, I said, isn't it amazing? Just the wave goes up and the wave goes down, the wave goes up and the wave goes down. He said, yes, sometimes it happens so fast you can hardly tell which is which. Isn't that so? Because wherever we are, the divine is with us. And this is the time when Jesus incarnates, and this is a very dynamic example of when God is with us. This season is so uplifted in ways that there's really nothing else, because America doesn't have, like India does, you know, festival after festival after festival. In India, every time you turn around, there's another festival happening in some wonderful way. But here, really, Christmas, Easter doesn't begin to touch it. Christmas is the only time when the entire atmosphere shifts into a more divine arena, and it helps us all. Master said it's extremely important at Christmas time not to dissipate this energy in mere worldliness, and you know, to spend as much of it as you can utilizing that God-reminding energy so that we can strengthen that bond. I've been working recently with a professional publicist in an effort to get the book that I've written about Swami Kriyananda more well known. And the world of the media is not exactly my world, but fortunately this woman that's helping us is very talented, and she's a good translator. She actually calls herself Storyteller to the Media. That's what her motto is. It's not who you know, it's who knows about you. Which I think is extremely clever. But so she's trying to find a way to take the message that we have to give, which is hardly mainstream culture, and just translate it. So one of these thoughts she had was the creation of sacred spaces in your own home. So I'm going to travel all the way to Sacramento to be on some television show for a total of, count them, 4 minutes to tell people. And I said, 4 minutes? She said, that's all television segments are 4 minutes. I made some rude remark about the entire culture in which we live, which she corrected me. But nonetheless, it's a restless world, so I have 4 minutes. So I'm trying to translate 40 years of spiritual life into 4 minutes on the subject of making a little altar in your home. But actually, it's been a very good exercise because I started really thinking about what is involved, and it occurred to me, of course, that's what we do at Christmas time, isn't it? People have these beautiful little creche scenes and the Christmas tree, and you put the lights up here, and not everybody does it in an entirely focused religious manner, but you create for a time a place, even in your own home, where you're celebrating the sacred. Now, those of us who are devotees, we have places like this all over our homes, but most people don't. Most people, where they live and work, is a shrine to work and family. And that's all it's a shrine to. And the big personal touch is that you bring in the picture of your grandmother and your kids and all of these things, which is not a bad thing in itself. But that expression is not the source of our satisfaction. You know, we may find great satisfaction through the family or whatever it is, but it's because to a certain extent we have opened ourselves to a higher dimension and we're living in a more refined element of ourselves. You know, we're willing to be more unconditional in our love. We're more selfless. The reason God inspires people with this deep desire to have children, it's very simple, because it forces us into a level of selflessness that we would not necessarily be inspired to reach otherwise. And then that experience of selflessness opens us to a kind of joy we didn't know was there. But it's not the raising of children that's the issue. It's the experience of selflessness. You see, because these great avatars come in. Jesus comes in. He didn't have a family. He did not marry Mary Magdalene and go have a family in Kashmir, as some people are trying to say nowadays. You know, sometimes they come up with these preposterous theories, and people say, well, what difference would it make? You know, so what if he was a family man? Well, good God. He can't have incarnated from the infinite, allowed himself to die on the cross and be resurrected just to raise a daughter or a son. I mean, really, can't we think a little higher than this? But the fact of the matter is we can't, really, because we're losing connection with that sacred. So we have this divine reading here today. Everywhere you look, you are actually looking at the divine. And this is not just sentimental. See, what we have a tendency today, because we're losing touch with real self-realization, we make that sentimental. And so, oh yes, you know, this is God everywhere. But it's not an actual experience of a transcended consciousness. And the problem then is when the wave shifts and that beautiful expression of the divine turns into one of the more challenging expressions of the divine, we haven't trained ourselves to see God everywhere. And so if it's pretty, it looks like God, and if it's challenging, it doesn't. So we become desperately upset, and we want to push it back over to this side. Even the touching beauty of seeing this, what used to be this little tiny baby, now this beautiful woman, has that bittersweet quality to it. Almost always hard for me to talk about it. One of the most poignant memories I have of my father. And he was very attached to me. And I was attached to him, but I was attached to him the way a child is attached to a parent, which is, how shall I put it, children use their parents, right? You know, we just use our parents. It took me many years to really cognize my parents as people. And also there's an unbearable burden sometimes that parents inadvertently put on their children, because they get so much happiness from their children that the children realize that if they have to withdraw, they're withdrawing their parents' happiness. And that's what happened between my father and I, because I went to college, and after I went to college, I never really came back home again for more than almost literally days at a time. And my father actually burst into tears in front of me, the only time I've ever seen him cry, just speaking of the realization that the child had disappeared into the adult. I mean, how do you balance all of that? Because it was the very joy in our life together that was now causing him to weep like that. I try to put that memory out of my mind. I practice detachment by trying to look at that memory without having it break my heart too. But I also remember at the time, you know, my response, the only word you could almost think of it in a human way was cruel, because I had to push it away. Because I couldn't allow my life to be ruled by the need to make him happy. I wasn't born for that, and I knew it. But there it was, you know, it seemed to be in my hands. And yet I had to pull it back like that. Where do we go with that? The only place to go is inward and upward. Either we have to decide that life is an agonizing experience, which really many people decide. They may not decide overtly, but just gradually as time passes, the possibility of joy diminishes. We settle for less and less. We scoff at the youthful idealism that we had, and we just push it away. And then we just sort of content ourselves. Yes, I'm perfectly happy. Yes, I'm just fine. I have my coffee in the morning, then I take a walk, and then I watch the news program, and then after that I go get the groceries, and you know. But God is present everywhere. God is infinite bliss. God is eternal freedom. God is courage beyond imagining that we could ever be so strong. But we have to practice that. We have to walk where Jesus walked. So the avatars show us, what does that life really look like? And so Jesus comes and he's completely free. This is why I scoff at the thought, you can't take that divine message of absolute detachment and power and joy and surrender to the divine without a moment's hesitation and just reduce it down to a nice, comfortable little life. Oh, he fell in love with Mary Magdalene and they had a little family. It's like, then we might as well just slit our wrists right now if that's the best we can aspire to. And you know, and did those little children fulfill all his hopes for perfect happiness, or did he marry someone you didn't like? Remember the movie, the one about Tevye, you know, the Fiddler on the Roof? You know, you have this Jewish man and his wonderful daughters, and you know, then one of the daughters marries a non-Jew. You know, it's just like, oh dear, now what do we do? You know, this just wasn't in the plan. And so poor Tevye, you know, in all his musical wonderness, has to just decide that I can't go beyond this. And we go through this huge emotional thing, and the poor girl is exiled from the family. Man, you think we haven't lived through that? Over and over and over. What do we do with all of that? No, there's only one answer. We have to go to God with it. Ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. Jesus is an awakened son. He's teaching us to walk where he walked, to have the joy that he had and the courage in the face of hardship, because we recognize behind it all, there's always the same one presence of God. But we have to practice that. Satan is there, as David performed for us so beautifully. I mean, it couldn't have been better. Not all of you could see, but I'm sure Ginny came in, David's wife came in with their little boy, Eli, and after the whole thing was over, did you hear little Eli say, Daddy, Daddy, like that? I don't think he thought of Daddy as the devil. But there he is, Daddy, Daddy. You know, the drama's just playing itself out. And we have to live it. We can't be afraid of it. We can't. Detachment is not to hold back. Some people think that to be detached means is to not get involved. No, it's just exactly the opposite. You see, when you're detached, in the sense, let me phrase it differently, when your deep attachment is really to God, then you can give everything your full heart, because what have you to fear? You're giving your whole heart to God in all circumstance, to the prisoner, to the hungry, to the weak, to the sick, to the tragic, to the joyful. It's to God you're giving your whole heart. When I was first married to David, and I had been single for a very long time, and, you know, I had these ideas about how I would handle this, and, you know, whatever you have, all the ideas we have until we're actually living. And immediately I discovered all this emotion, this marvelous thing called being a woman, which is a mixed bag of just this ability, which I acted out perfectly. I remember listening to David once. We lived in a dome at that time, and I was upstairs in the loft, and I was completely out of sight, and some young man came, and he was in some tragic romantic situation, and he went on and on, and I just wasn't supposed to be there, really, but I heard the whole thing. He was describing this situation with this woman he was in love with and how impossible she was, and she was pretty impossible. It just went on and on. And after it was all over, David said, well, that's women. He offered him a little more, but that was pretty much what he was describing, was just the way we are. So we're the moon. We wax, we wane, we wax, we wane, we wax, we wane, we wax, we wane. But I was sitting there in this experience of our early marriage, And it was one of those absolutely marvelous moments where David did absolutely nothing except just live his ordinary life. And I sat on the couch and gradually became extremely upset with him. I mean, we weren't even talking. Nothing was happening. I was just hallucinating all these, you know, with some little nuance of feeling came by and I attached it to this and then I thought of that and then this came up and then I became concerned and how is it ever going to, you know, like this. So after about an hour and a half, I'm totally upset, you know, and he, like men are, he said, you know, like, what? What? But I was upset and he had done nothing and I thought to myself later, man, what if he actually does something? What will I do then? But it was a really important moment because I had this extremely strong temptation to say, there's too much vulnerability in really loving someone. So here's a good idea. Let's just love a little less. Doesn't that sound like a good plan? Let's just close up a little bit, just become a little less sensitive, let's become a little less concerned, and I can call that detachment. I even have a philosophical concept I can apply to my fear. And then it will seem like I'm being noble instead of just cowardly. But fortunately, I couldn't fall for that. But then I went the other way and I thought, but you know, this is the beginning of a life together and I can't bear this. I'm too sensitive. And David is too strong-willed just to do everything I tell him to do, you know? And plus, no one is capable of making those kind of promises. You know, you think you will. You love each other and you want me to be like this. Oh yes, darling, for you I'll do this. And this is my child and I will sacrifice everything and I will always be patient and kind and I will be perfectly understanding. And I, you know, how long does it take us before the reality comes? It's just human nature. Nobody can make those kinds of promises. So I thought, well, what is there in life that's trustworthy? And of course, what we can trust is Divine Mother. But we can't trust Divine Mother to have the waves only go up. That's just not divine law. The wave goes up, the wave goes down, the wave goes up, the wave goes down. My friend goes to the tragic funeral of this woman that was almost a mother to him, and it seems all sadness, and then it brings with us all this blessing at the same time. You know, my father and I had this wonderful few years when I was growing up, and then I went away from him. What can you trust? You can trust that Divine Mother is giving us the life we need to bring us ultimately into a state of perfect attunement with bliss. And that if we cooperate with her by stepping forward into everything she asks of us and seeing in whatever it is her blessing hand, then no matter what happens, it will all be as it's meant to be. And that as it's meant to be is death. Yes, that's what Jesus shows us. But the afterside of that is the resurrection in perfect bliss. The death of our little naive, immature dreams that my darling little girl will always be my darling little girl, that my dear daddy will always be my dear daddy, that my sweet beloved will always be young and handsome. No, no, no. The only promise is that God is present in all of it, and if we trust that, then he, she will give us everything that our heart desires. What an extraordinary promise, isn't that so? That's why Swamiji says, he said it so many times, no one who has given their life to seeking God has ever said at the end of it, this was a bad deal, don't do it. The only humans who universally say this is the path for everyone is those who give themselves to God. Now, let us be among those. What do you say?